look at the Everett interpretation of quantum theory. So this is Hugh Everett III. This interpretation dates back to the 50s, and it's sometimes known as the many worlds interpretation. So let me, again, sort of remind you what the motivation for this was. So we saw the orthodox postulates of quantum theory, and we saw that the postulates 1 and 3, which are about, so the postulate 1, that the quantum state's complete representation, postulate 3 is about evolution for isolated systems, and it's unitary, and that seems to be inconsistent with postulates 2 and 4, which say that evolution should be, under measurements, should be indeterministic and discontinuous. So the idea of Everett's approach is going to be to just reject these two postulates and keep the others. So the quantum state is going to be all there is. It's going to describe reality completely. And systems are going to evolve unitarily, always. And measurements don't involve a different kind of evolution according to this model. And the details of the model are going to explain, why do we see the appearance of measurements as indeterministic. So here's the measurement problem, which this sort of interpretation is meant to resolve. The state that we had problems interpreting previously was the case where the spin system becomes entangled with the apparatus in this sort of entangled state here. And now the Everettian is going to take a totally different view of what to make of this state. So remember what the collapse theorist said. Collapse theorist said, look, this has to be eliminated. We have to invoke some new kind of dynamics to make sure that this gets reduced to one term or another, because this is something we just don't see. So for example, this would correspond to a pointer neither being, neither pointing up nor down. And that's something we just don't see. So this kind of state would say that we ought to see something weird. And we don't see those weird things, and so we can't imagine that this is the correct physical state. But the Everettian is going to say, well, let's think a little bit about what this would look like to an observer under the assumption that observers are also physical systems that are also described by Hilbert space and evolving unitarily by coupling to other systems and all that. So imagine we have an observer here who looks at the outcome of this measurement, and again, we just appeal to the first postulate of that axiom set, which is that although it may be hard to find that vector in Hilbert space that describes the physical state of the observer, the postulate guarantees that such a vector exists. Okay, so I'm going to write it as this here. The physical state of the observer is in some vector in Hilbert space which corresponds to being ready to make an observation. And although it may be very complicated to describe the actual interaction between the apparatus and the observer, we can just rely on the idea that the observer is actually a reliable observer. Just as we sort of relied on the idea of an apparatus being a good measurement, the fact that the apparatus was a good measurement allowed us to say that if the spin is up, then the apparatus should go from the ready state to the up state, some vector in Hilbert space representing getting the up outcome. And so the assumption that the observer is somehow reliable tells us that, whatever the interaction is, if that original spin is just up, and the apparatus is ready, and the observer is ready to observe, and then the apparatus indicates up, well, then the observer should come to a new state where they've observed that the apparatus is up. That's just what it means to be a proper observer. Okay, so we can sort of infer that if the spin's up, we should get this kind of evolution. If the spin's down, we should get this kind of evolution. And now, by linearity of unitary evolution, if the spin is in the superposition, we should get this. And so the question that the Everettian will ask is, what does it feel like to be an observer that ends up in this kind of quantum state? So you might say, well, how do we decide whether it feels strange or not? One thing you could do is say, suppose you define an operator which is meant to have one eigenvalue if the observer is having some experience that the outcome was definite, nothing strange about it, and a different eigenvalue if the observer thinks that the outcome had some indefinite outcome. Well, then each of these states of the observer is a plus one eigenstate. Each of these states of the observer corresponds to seeing a definite outcome. So if you ask, does this whole quantum state, is it an eigenstate of seeing a definite outcome? Yes. So you might say, well, the observer does have the property of seeing a definite outcome according to this. And if you think about it, you could imagine doing an experiment where you ask the observer, don't tell me what outcome you believe it is. Just tell me, do you think it had a definite outcome, or do you think something strange happened? And then imagine maybe some part of the observer that sort of introspects on this degree of freedom and decides whether, yes, I've seen something definite or not. Well, then under these sorts of interactions, in each term, the observer would decide, yes, I'm seeing something definite. And therefore, that would not be in superposition. I could to factor out the, yes, I'm seeing a definite state in that case. Just to make the point that this is meant to kind of undermine your confidence that this would correspond to experience something strange. So if you believe that we should assign properties to systems based on whether the quantum state's an eigenstate of the observable associated with that property, then you should think, oh, well, the property of observing something definite seems to hold for this quantum state. So if you asked an observer, you know, do you see something strange, they would reliably say no. If you ask, you know, what's the probability they'll see something definite, the answer is, with certainty, they're going to see something definite in this kind of state. So that's one fact about observers. Another interesting fact is that if you have multiple observers, and you make them both observe the same apparatus, then they'll agree on the outcome. So if I, you know, let the first observer observe, they'll go into this state with the apparatus, and then the second observer comes along, and they just become perfectly correlated with the first observer because they have the same, you know, reliable observation capabilities, and they'll see the outcome and become correlated. So it's also the case that, you know, not only does any given observer feel like they see an indefinite outcome, you have intersubjective agreement between all the observers who exist in this theory. So Everett noticed these sorts of facts about quantum theory, and he came to the following view. So this is a quote from his review paper on this. So he says, we shall deduce the probabilistic assertions of the collapse postulate as subjective appearances to such observers. So these are observers he's modeled in the quantum formalism, thus placing the theory in correspondence with experience. So we are then led to the novel situation in which the formal theory is objectively continuous and causal, while subjectively discontinuous and probabilistic. So he wants to say, yeah, the real state of the world, that evolves unitarily, totally deterministically, totally continuously. All of that is correct. But if you ask about the subjective experiences of a particular observer living in that world, they will see discontinuous and indeterministic evolution. But basically, they're mistaken. You know, they are limited by their subjective experience, so they don't see what's really going on. Good. So in this sort of approach, it's not the state of the observer or the system as such that's relevant. So you could say that neither the system nor the observer has a state of its own, as it would in an orthodox approach. But rather, they only have states relative to the states of the other system. So in fact, Everett's original paper was called the relative state interpretation of quantum theory. So Everett wants to say that spin up is not the state of the spin per se, but it's the state of the spin system relative to this particular state of the observer, and spin down is the state of the spin system relative to this particular state of the observer. And these two different quantum states for the observer correspond to different subjective experiences. So the spin has certain states relative to certain experiences of the observer. So here's another quote. The quantum jumps, so these are like the collapses, exist in our theory as relative phenomena, i.e. the states of an object system relative to chosen observer states show this effect, while the absolute states change quite continuously. And that's sort of in a nutshell what the idea of the theory is. So let me before going on to talk about some issues, let me just ask if kind of the bare bones of the idea is clear. Yeah? Okay. So I want to say something about many measurements and measurement statistics and preferred bases. And this notation is a bit cumbersome. So I'm just going to introduce a shorthand here. So instead of up and down, I'm going to have plus and minus states for my spin. The observer and the apparatus are sort of going to be lumped together as just sort of one big observer. And I'm going to denote their states as O0, O plus, and O minus for, you know, ready, has observed up, has observed down. So this is how I'm going to summarize that equation up here. Okay, so let me tell you about one of the criticisms, one of the issues with the many worlds interpretation that's been discussed in the literature, and it's called the preferred basis problem. So when we have this interaction between a spin and observer and we go into this entangled state, we're told by the evidence that we should interpret this as the objective state of the world, but each of the branches in this decomposition corresponds to a different subjective experience. And the question is, well, why? What picks out this particular branching structure? Because a branching structure is really just a choice of basis for a vector. So I can write a vector relative to many bases in the Hilbert space. And I've made one choice of basis here, but I could have made another choice of basis. So here's an example. I can always rewrite this in this way. If you just do the sum, you'll find that certain cross terms cancel, and these two vectors are equal. So this is just a different basis for representing exactly the same quantum state. These states of the observer, so the positively superposed and negatively superposed states, I mean, these are like Schrodinger cat states, where the observer is sort of superposed, observing up and observing down. But there are, they span the same 2D space that these guys do. They form an orthogonal basis. These two states are not orthogonal, unless A and B happen to be 1 over 2. But because these guys are orthogonal, you know, these two products are certainly orthogonal. And this is a perfectly valid way of rewriting that state. So you might ask, well, why don't we say that there's a subjective experience associated with each of these branches? And if we try to do that, then we would have the problem that in each of these branches, the observer does not observe something definite. The observer is in this strange Schrodinger cat-like state in each of the branches. So what picks out this branching structure from this branching structure? So let me put it to you. How would you try to solve this problem, assuming you wanted to salvage the Everett approach? Yes?
Because we don't see superpositions as observers. Like, I don't see something being both up and down in everyday experience. So therefore, the observer cannot be a superposition.
So you're saying that we, you know, just by the kinds of experiences we have, we say, well, look, this just isn't the kind of quantum state of an observer that's to which you could easily associate a particular subjective experience. Is that the idea? Neither is this. And so, you know, this is the only branching structure relative to which I associate, you know, well-defined subjective experiences. So let me try to play devil's advocate. A couple of questions. You know, one, we sort of know what we want the answer to be, but the game here is to try to imagine that we have some rule that applies sort of at the level of atoms, and we don't want our interpretation to have to refer to measurements or observers explicitly. So you wouldn't want a rule that says, you know, the right branching structure, you know, is the one such that observers feel comfortable. It has to be, you know, in terms of, you know, what the physical state of the atoms making up the observer are. So I might ask, you know, what is it about this physical state that's different from this physical state such that this corresponds to some sort of well-defined subjective experience, but this does not? This is another perfectly valid state of the collection of atoms making up an observer.
Drawing a distinction between an observer and a simple apparatus here. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you wouldn't need to introduce this observer. You could just have the apparatus being an up state or down state. The interpretation would be fine. So you're already introducing something special about the observer into this formalism. Since you're already introducing that, I may as well make it something that agrees with what the average observer would experience.
So you're saying the Everettian can't really get away with talking just about atoms, but sort of needs to talk about the observer to describe the branching structure?
Yeah, Well, it seems that way, because otherwise, why would you introduce the observer into the experiment on the last side in the first place? All you would need is the measurement apparatus.
I guess the Everettian introduces the observer because they want to make a point about, you know, essentially saying, look, you know, it's the task of a physical theory to, at the very least, kind of reproduce our experiences. So, you know, the problem with Schrodinger cats, we are told, is that we would be led to experience something strange that we don't actually experience, according to the theory. Well, we're going to, you know, model the observers explicitly because, you know, we think that the quantum dynamics applies to everything, including observers. And we're going to argue that when you do that, you see that actually observers don't observe anything weird, as long as you have the right interpretation of what their subjective experiences look like. So that's their motivation for sort of throwing the observers in there. But let me take a couple of other views. Let me start with Miriam.
What if you appealed to some sort of notion of simplicity versus complexity of your branching structure, where you want your branching structure to be as simple as possible, where you define simple in terms of, like, number of terms in it or something, sort of like we have a notion of entropy.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, the top branching structure, which corresponds to, you know, what subjective observers actually experience, is much simpler than the second one.
So you mean simpler, perhaps, in this case, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the observer is actually a very composite system, and this kind of state would involve entanglement among the components of the observer, whereas these sorts of states presumably would have a lot less entanglement in them.
Exactly,
so you could say,
got some kind of entropy associated with it, right? The entropy of the entanglement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you eliminate that in the first one.
Yeah. Let me come back to your suggestion in just a few minutes. Somebody else had their hand up before. Cool.
So we might be thinking of the plus as particle has up for the z component of its spin. And so the plus and minus describe states of a component, of, let's say, the z component of a spin, and O describes states of the observer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the second line. I guess the problem is being an observer who is in a state described by the second line would feel weird, but we know exactly what it feels like. It feels like being an observer in the state described by the first line. So it wouldn't feel strange.
It sounds to me like you're probably not saying the following, which I think would be contrary to what the Everettians are claiming, that there's a single subjective experience associated with this quantum state. These are just two decompositions of the same quantum state. It's just one quantum state. And the Everettian wants to say, no, there isn't a single subjective experience. There are multiple subjective experiences. So I assume you want to agree with that. And you want to say, well, you know, it's this pair of subjective experiences that the philosophers would say supervene on this vector. So that, you know, if the vector is this, then there's these two subjective experiences. And there's no pair of subjective experiences associated with these guys, which is, I think, a bit similar to what Deanna was saying earlier. That somehow these things just don't have subjective experiences associated with them. I can write down these vectors, but they don't correspond to any perspective of an observer. Are you saying something similar?
Seems like there is a subjective experience associated with them, and the experience of being in the state described by the bottom lines.
This one? Yeah.
The bottom lines, that just the whole
this
bottom
whole,
state.
Oh, this whole thing. Yeah.
The experience of that is the same as the experience of the first one.
But as I said, the Everettian certainly wants to say that there is no single experience associated with this vector. There are multiple experiences.
This set of experiences.
This set of experiences, right. So you want to say it's the same set of experiences here and here. So then, my challenge to that notion was, well, what is it about the set of atoms which tells me that, you know, this kind of state of those atoms corresponds to a subjective experience? And therefore, the set sort of is read off of this pair of states. as opposed to the set of experiences being read off of this pair of states. You know, what rule in terms of those atoms? So Miriam was saying, well, maybe it's something to do with, you know, the simplest state, the one that has kind of the least complexity or entanglement. That would be a rule for determining how we read off the set of subjective experiences from the universal wave function. Let me get a couple more points of view.
I would guess that the way out is by noting that systems that are conscious are generally very complex. And so actually, those two simple tensor products will actually be a tensor product with a huge amount of particles.
Uh-huh.
And since different states of consciousness will be differently entangled with this environment, you'll have decoherence, and
okay.
So they won't interfere in the second line. So the interference you see there is then actually not right. It's because we're ignoring the entanglement.
I see. So you're saying that this picture is not complete because we just have an observer here, but we don't have an environment.
Yes, and then the environment will destroy the superposition you see there.
Good. All right. Let me address that. Let's throw in an environment. So the environment starts off in some state, E naught. This could be very complicated. It doesn't really matter what the details of this particular environment are. But let's assume that the environment is very efficient at carrying away information about which of the two states the apparatus and observer are in. So if the apparatus and observer go into the state O plus, then the environment goes into the state E plus. And if they go to the state O minus, then the environment goes into the state E minus. And in general, those two states will be very close to orthogonal if the environment's very large and it's coupling in a sort of standard way to the apparatus and the observer. Okay, so then you might say, all right, okay, this is going to be the basis relative to which we sort of judge what the subjective experiences are, but I can always rewrite that vector this way. If I write down this basis for the observer, you know, the positive superposition, the negative superposition. And then I say, well, what's the relative state of now spin and environment? The relative state to that guy is just this, and the relative state to that guy is that. And you know, these aren't generally orthogonal, but this is a perfectly good basis in, you know, this pair and this pair are orthogonal. This is a perfectly good basis in which I could write that vector. And again, I could ask, why is it that we should interpret the set of subjective experiences to be associated with this branching structure rather than that one? Getting a puzzled vibe from you right now. That's good. Let me tell you about a couple suggestions, and it'll touch on some things that we've heard. I mean, the decoherence idea is a good idea, but it's a bit. I think what people emphasize typically when they appeal to decoherence has to do with evolution and not just looking at a static vector at one given time. So let's talk a bit about evolution. Suppose I throw in a second environment. Okay, so I'm going to just denote that E superscript 2. It's a second environment. And I'm going to now drop the spin and the first environment because the second environment is interacting with the apparatus and the observer, not these other guys, and so I'm not going to worry about them. So let's look. Suppose you're an observer who's in this branch of the wave function. So your subjective experiences correspond to this one here. And then you end up interacting with this environment. Well, the evolution of that particular branch will be this, that essentially the second environment, if it interacts with the observer in the same way that the first environment did, it's just also carrying away information about the O plus O minus basis. And so it's really just going to leave the observer in the same state that it found it. Whereas if I start with this branch of the wave function, and I say, what happens to that observer state when it interacts with that environment? Well, it becomes entangled with the environment. And if I rewrite this back in the O plus, the positive superposition and negative superposition states, in this branch of the wave function, you don't stay in this state. You go into a mixture of this guy and this guy, if I just look at the reduced density operator of the observer. So there's kind of a difference in the sorts of evolutions that a particular basis of observer states undergoes in these two branching structures. So in this structure, the state of the observer sort of, you know, remains O plus, persists as we get more and more environmental interactions. Whereas over here, if you wanted to claim that, you know, the subjective experience is there's a subjective experience associated with this basis element and this basis element, then very shortly after, you know, when this thing interacts with the environment, all of a sudden it branches again. And now you're equally likely to be in this subjective experience or this subjective experience. So if you're going to claim that there's a set of experiences associated with this branching structure, then you'll also have to claim that there's this constant kind of fluctuation of what your experiences are between these two alternatives, even though all you're doing is interacting with some environment that's kind of very typical and realistic environmental interaction. So this seems like, you know, any subjective experiences relative to this basis would correspond to some sort of fluctuating experience back and forth between two sorts of ideas. Now you could say, well, that's a criticism of Everett. You know, there's nothing wrong with that kind of, it just shows that Everettians haven't yet told us how to interpret the branch. But what it does is it gives you an idea for a criterion you might add. You might say, well, let's look at the this branching structure and this one and ask how predictable, how kind of close to deterministic is the evolution of a given basis element. So the O plus O minus basis elements will evolve quite deterministically and very predictably, whereas these other guys will evolve very indeterministically because they're going to be constantly going into mixtures. And so that's an alternative kind of criterion which has a similar flavor to the one that Miriam suggested, where maybe you look at the, you know, entanglement among the components of these guys. And to some extent, you know, this sort of environmental interaction, you know, basically sees the component structure of this guy. And if it's highly entangled like this one, then you get this indeterministic behavior. And if it's simple like that one, you don't. So, you know, in this case, the two criteria are not so different. Yes?
But aren't we cheating in a way because we're giving the environment the property that we wanted to have? So we're saying the environment is that thing that couples to a definite definite observer, such a way that it stays as a definite observer and couples to a superposition of observers and then branches the positions. But then you're resolving the problem by defining your environment as the thing that recognizes what is the correct observer.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying, like, we're assuming here that the environment is measuring the O plus O minus basis rather than measuring, for example, this basis. Why do we assume that? And the answer to that question, I think the Everettian is actually has a good reason to do that, which is that they just say, well, what do typical environments do? Let's just look at the unitary that couples observers to environments and see what kinds of couplings are standard. And this kind of an environment that measured this basis would be just as hard as, you know, building a quantum computer that, you know, was isolated from its environment, because, you know, these sorts of states are extremely hard to preserve their coherence. So natural models of the environment tend to work like this. You know, they tend to measure the positions of things. That's what we saw in electron Bohmian mechanics and on collapse theories. I mean, we didn't really see it because I've never sort of shown you, you know, starting from the Hamiltonian of the universe, let's see a model of decoherence and prove that it decoheres in the position basis. But in your quantum course, you had a problem involving, you know, spin decoherence. And I guess you've never seen a problem for continuous degrees of freedom. But, you know, believe me that, you know, you just put down sort of very natural couplings, you find that it's always the position basis that gets measured. So so it seems to me that they can say, look, the nature of the environment's coupling to the observer, that's just given by the Hamiltonian of the universe, and, you know, physics tells us what that's likely to be. So we're allowed to appeal to that. And then they want to claim, there's certain people who will say, oh, you know, we can add to the Everett interpretation this kind of mathematical criterion for picking out a branching structure, which has to do with how predictable the basis elements are in a particular branch decomposition. Good. So this is just what I said before. One of these bases is predictable, the other is not. And there's a nice paper written by Adrian Kent back in, I think, 1990, which is sort of a famous criticism of the Everett interpretation. He talked about the preferred basis problem. And what he said was that no preferred basis can arise from the dynamics or from anything else unless some basis selection rule is given. So we sort of heard a couple ideas of that, a mathematical criterion for figuring out under what basis, for which basis should we assume there's a set of experience associated with it. And so, you know, looking at the entanglement of the basis states, or looking at how much predictability you have in a given basis or another basis under typical environmental interactions, those would all be examples of a basis selection rule. And so various people have tried to come up with good basis selection rules. And generically, they have problems. They can't necessarily do a good job of solving the measurement problem in certain typically exotic scenarios. But nonetheless, it's a possible way of salvaging Everett's interpretation. It so happens that most Everettians today don't take this route. And they interpret things a little bit differently. So I'm going to tell you about the kind of standard response to the preferred basis argument. So the response I'm going to give you is based on work by David Deutsch and in particular David Wallace. So you can read their papers if you're interested in this. And they want to reject Kent's claim. And they say, look, no extra mathematical criteria is needed to select out a basis. That's inappropriate because real things, macroscopic objects and worlds, should really be thought of as emergent properties, not things that are kind of fundamental and specified by some mathematical criterion. So they're instead, you know, rather vague sorts of properties. So the idea is the following. You know, here's a real physical object, and it doesn't exist in the fundamental axioms of our best physical theories. So you're taking the course on the standard model, and I'm pretty sure that there's nothing in the standard model that refers to that real thing which we call tigers. But the fact that it's not there in the standard model doesn't mean that we think tigers are unreal. So we still think tigers are real, we just assign, we understand the reality in a different way as a kind of emergent feature of a very complex object. So they're real but not directly represented in the axioms. And effectively, we understand tigers to be patterns that sort of exist in a collection of objects that are undergoing dynamics over time. And you know, in this case, they're patterns that ultimately behave like tigers. So if you see a pattern that's behaving like a tiger, you know that you identify it as a tiger. So essentially, Wallace here is appealing to a certain criterion for reality sort of an emergent criterion. And Daniel Dennett, the philosopher Daniel Dennett, has a nice summary of this sort of notion. He says, a macro object is a pattern, and the existence of a pattern as a real thing depends on the usefulness, in particular the explanatory power and predictive reliability of theories which admit that pattern in their ontology. So there's a sort of a turn to the pragmatic. Instead of saying there's some mathematical criterion that defines this thing, you just say if talking about a certain kind of pattern is very useful for making predictions and for explaining what's going on, then it makes sense to assign some reality to that pattern. So in the context of many worlds, these guys, like Deutsch and Wallace, would say that the preferred basis is picked up by decoherence. Because in a certain basis, you have patterns that have explanatory and predictive power. And in other bases, you don't have such patterns. So we already saw that, you know, in the basis of the observer that gets measured by the environment, we have a lot of predictability. So if at one time, you know, the apparatus is indicating up, then we can safely predict that, you know, a few minutes later, it's still going to indicate up. Whereas in that other basis, things were fluctuating wildly back and forth, and there wasn't, you know, much of a story we could tell there that made any sense. So this breed of Everettian will say, you know, therefore, in the first basis, we kind of have a pattern that is useful to us, and so we can assign some reality to that basis. But the other one, it's just not useful, so there's nothing really worth assigning reality to. So in this sort of view, because the patterns aren't precisely defined, there's no mathematical criterion for them, They're rejecting Kant's idea, but they claim that that doesn't detract from the reality of that particular branching structure. Give me just a minute. So you know, some nice examples of this about how there are things that you believe are real, but they aren't precisely defined. So I take it that you all believe that mountains are real, but you can't give me a precise criterion for where the mountain ends and the valley begins. That doesn't influence your belief in the reality of the mountain. Or to take one of my favorite examples, the notion of a particular species seems to be a valuable notion. But if you look at the theory of evolutionary biology and you go back in time, you'll see that the organisms just change very gradually, and there's no mutation that indicates the beginning of the species of tiger. You just go back in time and you see things that become slowly more and more different from tigers. And there's no natural point at which, you know, one species ends and another species begins. But we still think that these are useful concepts, and we associate reality with those concepts. So the Everettians want to say, similarly with this branching structure, it's a fuzzy notion, but it's still reliable and useful. And certain decompositions will have these patterns in them that'll, you know, make sense and have predictive powers. Others won't. We interpret it according to the branching structure that does. You still have a question?
When you say patterns are not precisely defined, it seems like you mean not the idea of what a pattern is imprecisely defined,
right,
but the pattern that we recognize as a tiger, or what it is,
right,
to be tiger, is imprecisely,
yeah,
defined.
Yeah, we don't have a kind of mathematically precise definition of what it is to be a tiger, where the mountain begins, where a species begins, all that sort of thing. Nor do we have a mathematically precise definition of which branching structure we should use to interpret the universal wave function. We just kind of have a vague notion that certain branches admit of useful stories and others do not. Yeah?
How does this correspond to our experience of the world? Because if you observe, the outcome is up, that's not because it's useful, it's because that's what you're experiencing. How does that play?
Well, perhaps they would give the argument that when a species is evolving and evolution is kind of determining what that species should pay attention to, it's useful to pay attention to classical facts about the world because those are very predictable facts and they can be useful to you. And so, once the outcome of a quantum measurement has been registered in some classical data, then, it's going to persist and it's worth you paying attention to that and remembering that and so on. But, evolutionary adaptation had no reason, for you to pay much attention to other bases because they're so unpredictable. That's the kind of explanation it would give. So, yeah, ultimately it's going to say that, classicality in the universe arises by virtue of environmental decoherence. The classical stuff is what's highly predictable. That's the kind of stuff where there are useful stories and to be told, and so that sort of classical basis, the basis in which there are classical stories is the one relative to which we should interpret the wave function. And you're going to see a little bit more about decoherence in the next problem set. What are your thoughts on this response to kind of Kant's criterion? Is this a solution of the preferred basis problem? Yes?
I have a question about the use of the term ontology here.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start talking about, theories that incorporate certain things into their ontology, and then what should be incorporated into their ontology depends on what's useful,
mm-hmm,
to us. But then isn't that now epistemic? Because what's useful to us is an epistemic phenomenon, but what we're incorporating into our ontology depends on something epistemic, and now I'm now I'm just confused.
It's not clear to me that what's useful to us necessarily is epistemic in the sense that
you had some species on some other alien planet that evolved,
yeah,
completely differently, that,
yeah,
that evolved to notice other bases, then what they would consider useful wouldn't be what we consider useful. So then they would incorporate something different into their theories of ontology, but then that.
Well, I guess what these guys will want to claim is that the laws of physics tend to dictate what is and is not useful to you. I mean, some of your circumstances, you know, depending on your circumstances, certain things may be useful to you that aren't useful to somebody else. But as long as, you know, these beings on another planet are governed by the same physics, they will also only be able to have predictability in those bases of the branches of the wave function that are kind of evolving classically. And so they also would sort of not find much use in paying attention to other bases that don't evolve predictably. So they could sort of predict that, you know, all organisms that evolve in this universe that, you know, want to pay attention to things that are predictable will pick out the same sort of basis. But, you know, what I was saying earlier about it not necessarily being epistemic, you know, an epistemic concept like the probability of rain tomorrow, that might be useful. But so is an ontological concept, like, you know, the wind speed. That's also a useful concept. And I think what they're trying to make a distinction between here are ontological concepts that are kind of primitive, that might appear in the axioms of theory, like, you know, the notion of fundamental particles, and ontological concepts that are emergent. So, you know, the center of mass is not a fundamental degree of freedom, but it's still an ontological concept. Or, you know, the notion of liquidity, it's not something I can easily describe in terms of the fundamental particles. It's more of an emergent property. But we think that, you know, we can talk about liquidity and so forth. And so they're just saying, look, you know, we have this notion of the distinction between fundamental things and emergent things. Kent was asking for a fundamental criterion for the preferred basis, but that's just the wrong approach. We should, you know, the preferred basis is really an emergent thing, and so we should just be looking for bases that are useful to us, like the concept of liquidity is useful to us. Yeah, go ahead.
So let me just use the word consciousness as a shortcut for an observer who sees a definite outcome.
Okay.
So is it then correct to say that what we first did today was take the notion of an conscious person, and then show that in the evolution, upspin has a certain conscious person with it, and downspin has a certain conscious person with it. But that now, oppositely, actually, David Wallace is implying that we define the conscious person as either the one as the cat that belongs to up, and the cat that belongs to down. So so that is actually our definition of consciousness in we define our notion of consciousness as the thing that is accompanied with the definite spin.
I don't think so, because if I just said what is the relative state of the observer to a particular spin? Actually, I mean that question is not quite well defined, because, you know, if I have this sort of scenario, then I can certainly ask what's the relative state to, say, the spin-up state of the rest of the universe when I'm in this state here. And so then, you know, the relative state of spin-up will be this, and the relative state of spin-down will be this. But I can also, and I haven't done it here, but I could decompose the spin into some other basis, like up plus, let's say, up along x and down along x. And then the relative state will be things like O plus E plus O minus E minus. And the ever-ending doesn't want to say there's a subjective experience associated with that. So it's not as if the spin determining the observer's state of consciousness would be a bit like, you know, the tail wagging the dog. They want to say that, you know, the spin is observed to have a well-defined spin because there's certain bases for the observer that are picked out as, you know, embodying patterns over time that kind of have predictive power and they're useful. And so there's a subjective experience associated with those patterns. And that picks out a relative state for the spin. And it's the relative state that observers in the universe will assign to the spin after the collapse. You know, they apply the collapse postulate because the state of the spin is well defined relative to their subjective experience. Okay. So I'm going to move on from the preferred basis problem to another criticism of the many worlds interpretation, which is about the interpretation of probabilities in this interpretation. So there's going to be roughly two kinds of problems. I mean, there's many problems people look at, but there's two problems that people think a lot about. The first one has been called the incoherence problem. And the idea is this. How can anything possibly meet the description of probability in a theory which is deterministic and all possible outcomes occur? So there's nothing to be ignorant about. So in the fundamental theory, the evolution is totally deterministic and nothing is evolving stochastically. We know that all outcomes of the experiment will occur in parallel. So let's look at a specific example. Say I'm running this Stern-Gerlach experiment many times, all on the same initial state. So, you know, the first spin is prepared in this state, so is the second, the third, the fourth. And I have an apparatus for each one of them. And I evolve them together one by one, so the spin becomes entangled with the apparatus. And at the end, I'll have these entangled states for spin and apparatus for each one of these cases, so four times over. And I could just do this for n different systems. And what I find is that, if I expand the overall wave function, I'll have these product states all summed together. And, you know, the different elements of that big entangled state will have all the possible sequences of outcomes that you might see. So that, you know, the case where you got the all up outcome, cases where you got a half up and half down, all the way to cases where you got the all down outcome. In, you know, this, you know, after the first measurement, I get this branching. After the second measurement, I branch out for each of these guys and so on. So you could say, you know, according to the Everettian, different branches of this wave function correspond to different experiences. So, you know, in this branch, there's a subjective experience that sees this sequence of outcomes, and similarly with all the others. But this is very much unlike the collapse approach or the de Broglie-Bohm approach. In the collapse approach, you'd say, and the wave function collapses to one of those guys. The other guys are gone. Or in the Bohmian approach, you would say, one of these branches is occupied because the Bohmian position lies in the support of that branch, and the others are unoccupied. So in both those cases, there's sort of an actual one and a bunch of ones that were possible but are not realized. The Everettian approach is not like that. It says, no, they all have the same status. They're all actual. They're all equally real. No one of them is picked out as preferred. So you can't really say, well, the probability of a particular sequence, you know, I should interpret as, you know, the probability that I end up experiencing this. Because, you know, a version of you experiences that, but there's a version of you that experiences every other thing as well. So in that context, the question is, what could the probability possibly mean when there's no uncertainty about what's going to occur? Every sequence will be observed. There's a second problem, which is sometimes called the problem of theory confirmation, which would be to say that if the theory predicts that every possible sequence will be observed, then why should seeing, say, the all plus outcomes cast any doubt on the theory? Normally, we would say, you know, if I go to the lab and I measure, say, consistently spin up, even though I've prepared, say, an X spin eigenstate at the beginning, I'm measuring Z spin, if I always get the up outcome, that might lead me to think that the quantum theory was improbable, that it doesn't describe experiments well. And yet, some argue, in this sort of theory, you predict that with certainty there's somebody out there who's seeing exactly that, according to the theory. It has to happen. So why should seeing that lead you to think that the theory's wrong? You know, you've just seen something that the theory predicts will definitely happen. So it's, again, the question is, you know, why shouldn't I think of each of these sequences occurring with probability 1? As opposed to the probabilities that the quantum theory assigns. So I can start to tell you about what people have responded to these sorts of objections, but maybe I'll pause here if any of you want to tell me what you think the solution is, or your ideas for salvaging Everett from this sort of criticism.
Okay, what if instead of just looking at sort of here you have one ensemble of n systems that you've set up in the laboratory, mm-hmm. if you look at the whole history of the universe and you say, okay, and you just do a counting argument, you say how many histories in the universe end with, you know, someone building this apparatus and, you know, it coming out this way and then can you do some sort of counting argument over like all possible histories where you say there's this many possible histories that lead to this happening, and this many possible histories that all lead to this happening. So therefore, the probability of me seeing this outcome instead of this outcome is just the ratio of the total number of histories. And then if you keep seeing things that have a very like small number of histories corresponding to them, that's extremely, extremely improbable. And if, you know, everyone keeps seeing that, then you're pretty sure your theory is wrong.
That is very similar to a kind of standard response. Let me just point out that, you know, if I think about the past history of this experiment, you know, it might be that there's some certain fraction of the history of the universe wherein I end up starting this whole experiment. But the question of, you know, what the probability of a given sequence is sort of is it doesn't really matter what those relative frequencies are. So what kind of matters is the relative frequency of these sorts of branches. But I think what you said could be applied equally well here. Look, we can just count up branches and we could say, yeah, there's a whole bunch of subjective experiences, but those subjective appearances appear with different frequencies in, you know, the branched decomposition of the universal wave function. So for example, you know, the case where I have all of the outcomes the same occur according to that counting measure much less frequently than the case where I have equal numbers of up and down outcomes. And so I'm going to interpret the probability that quantum theory assigns to seeing plus to that relative frequency of say, you know, half plus versus, you know, any other kind of sequence. Yes?
The problem I would say to dismiss the theory because there's a low frequency of observing a certain outcome, like all pluses, and you always observe that outcome. So you say that theory is therefore wrong, which seems very insane, is that we only have access to one universe. So it's like you have a pair of die, or a pair of dice, and you roll a two. Well, that's a really unlikely outcome. But you've only got one roll of the dice. So are you going to say my probability theory that describes what these two six-sided die should give most of the time? Are you going to say that's wrong because the one roll you got gave you a two?
Well, okay. Let me come back and then maybe you can respond. So the argument, this is about sort of the theory confirmation business that we talked about earlier. Where was that? Yeah, on the bottom. Somebody who made that criticism could say, well, with the dice, after I'd rolled it once, I wouldn't feel very confident in ruling out many hypotheses about how that dice is weighted. So let's say, you know, I assume it's a fair dice, and I roll it once, and I see a one, you know, that's not going to, or I roll two dice, and I see a two. That's not going to suddenly shake my confidence that these are fair dice, because I know that's possible. It's, you know, I would have expected another outcome. But if I roll it 10 times and I'm always getting two, well, that might start to shake my confidence that they're fair dice. And if I roll it even more numbers of times, I still admit that it's possible that this could be a sequence of coincidences, but the probability I assign to the hypothesis fair dice starts going down and down and down. And the idea here with this objection is we'd like to be able to say the same for you know, Stern-Gerlach experiments, that if I did a large number of spin Z measurements on a spin X system, and I kept seeing the up outcome, then eventually that would sort of undermine my confidence in the truth of quantum theory, according to standard interpretations. But the skeptic wants to say, I don't see how to make that fly in the Everett interpretation. Why should seeing the all plus outcome undermine my confidence in Everett's interpretation of quantum theory? Because Everett says, yeah, there'll be a perspective that definitely sees that. With probability one, somebody's going to see that. So it seems like it's a totally valid prediction of the theory. Unlike a usual view on probability. So I think this skeptical argument would agree with you, but is claiming that, you know, Everett can't make sense of that. Yes?
Even if it's difficult to see a universal notion of probability in the Everett interpretation, can't I, as an observer, think about a probability that I have a certain set of experiences? So can't the Everett interpretation involve probability in that subjective way?
Actually, yes. There is a kind of response that a lot of Everettians make. that we should think about probabilities in the Everett interpretation in a more Bayesian way as measures of our degrees of subjective belief about future things, not as relative frequencies over a set of possibilities. And I'm not going to say much about that, but I'll say a little bit about it in a couple of slides from now. It's going to be coupled with decision theory. So yeah, let me get back to that. Go ahead.
But do the coefficients A and B actually still have an influence on what you observe? Can you still make the claim that probability of observing spin off is modulus A squared? I don't know how you would make that argument.
And under which response?
Just in many worlds.
In many worlds. Well, let's talk about Miriam's suggestion that relative frequencies count up the relative frequency of, say, getting half up and half down. That would suggest that regardless of the values of A and B, when I ask, what's the most likely relative frequency of up versus downs, it's going to be a half. So if you look at different, so the point is this, that in the limit where you've done a large number of these experiments, you expect that most of the measure will go over to having a particular frequency of plus versus minus outcomes. And that particular frequency will be given, the particular frequency that you get depends on the measure over this space. So, what is the typical frequency? Well, if I take a counting measure, so the counting measure just says I'm going to weight all of these guys equally, then according to the counting measure, the lion's share of these sequences will have half plus and half down, regardless of the value of A and B, because I'm just counting branches. And counting branches doesn't care at all what the amplitude sitting in front of the branch is. But if I take a different measure over these guys, so I take the Born measure, so that's just, write out the universal wave function and look at the mod squared of the amplitude sitting in front of each of these terms. And then I ask, relative to that measure, what's the most typical frequency I see? The answer is going to be A squared of the pluses and 1 minus A squared of the minuses. So this appeal to relative frequencies leaves you with another question, which is, what is the appropriate measure over the space of branches relative to which I should sort of interpret probability? And so there's been a kind of criticism of this whole sort of approach. This is actually a kind of a very old idea. And in some of the earlier work, people tried to derive the probabilistic predictions in the Everett interpretation from deterministic predictions in the following sort of way. They said, let's define an operator that measures the frequency of plus outcomes. And so they tried, they argued that they could define such an operator. And then they said, in the limit that n goes to infinity, the universal quantum state actually goes into an eigenstate of that frequency operator, which picks out precisely the case where you have A squared plus outcomes. And so the frequency, the eigenvalue of the frequency operator is A squared if the original state had amplitude A for plus. And so they say, but that's a deterministic prediction. I'm just talking about the eigenvalue of this operator for which the universal state is an eigenstate. And so the objection to that kind of approach, so you can read this paper by Caves and Schack, for example, is that it kind of gets things backwards, that if you look at the law of large numbers, your inferences run not from frequencies to probabilities, but from probabilities to statistical properties of frequencies. So what they're saying is that when you look at the law of large numbers, there's a measure given there, some measure over your space of possibilities. And what the law of large numbers says is that with measure close to 1, the frequency you see in these sequences will go over to the measure that was assigned to the plus outcome. And so measure is fundamental, and statements about frequencies are derived. Actually, the law of large numbers says just with high probability, with a large measure, we will see that. And so if you don't have a notion of measure already, you can't make that statement. Whereas these sorts of arguments are trying to kind of derive a measure from a set of frequencies. And the claim is that that's just inappropriate. Okay, a couple of other objections. So you could say, well, in any case, this sort of argument, which tries to derive probabilistic statements from deterministic statements, never really applies because we only ever have finite sequences of measurements, never an infinite sequence. So the world doesn't go into eigenstates of the frequency operator because I've never done an infinite sequence. And furthermore, the universal wave function actually is never even an eigenstate of anybody performing some sequence of measurements. Because way back in time, there was some quantum fluctuation that determined whether the Earth formed at all. And so if I look at the truly universal wave function, including those other branches, well, it's not an ideal state of anybody here performing any experiment. So I can't really appeal to operators for which the universal wave function is an eigenstate in these sorts of arguments. All right, let's talk a little bit about the response that takes this sort of Bayesian approach. First I have to tell you what the second problem is, which we've just discussed, that we need an argument to justify a particular claim for what the measure over those branches should be. So the Averettians want to claim that it's the mod squared amplitudes. That's the right measure over branches to use to get probabilities. And the question is, well, why that measure? Why not the counting measure? Why not some other measure entirely? And the standard response, so this is originally due to David Deutsch and has been pursued by others since then, is that we should think of probabilities within the Everett approach as just expressing something about the preferences of agents. So there is an approach to probability theory classically, which is like this. It's part of decision theory. So the idea is something like, you assign a particular utility to, all sorts of commodities and, things that could happen in the world. And so, for example, we might assign, you might value money. And when you buy a lottery ticket, that's, if it wins, it's worth $100. You could just say, look, I define the probability of winning the lottery as the price I would pay for the lottery ticket that awards me $100. So I want to make it so that I definitely don't expect to lose. So if I think that the lottery will give me a 1 in 100 chance of winning, then I'm willing to pay $1 for the lottery ticket that pays off $100. And that's what I mean by probability. It's a statement about my preferences. And so this idea is that we should look at these observers in the Everett interpretation and ask how they should buy lottery tickets and what, if they're being rational, they ought to do. So the Born weight, the Born rule weight, plays the same role in weighting utilities and decision theory as probabilities do in classical one-world indeterministic theories. And any rational agent, according to this view, who knows the Born rule weight of an outcome to be P is rationally compelled to act as if that outcome had probability P. So the idea is that the agents in an Everettian world will act just like agents in a classical indeterministic world. And they will assign probabilities P according to the Born rule, just as an expression of their preferences. So if there's large literature about this, I'm not going to go into the details. One of the main criticisms is that if you look at the assumptions, so Deutsch has a proof that it's kind of like, it's a proof of decision theory. So there's a lot of standard work on if you make these assumptions about a rational agent's preferences, for example, transitivity. If they prefer A to B and they prefer B to C, then they'll prefer A to C, etc. You make a bunch of assumptions about the preferences. Then it follows that they will have to use probability theory to calculate their expected utility. And so these guys are doing something similar in an Everettian picture. And they've got a bunch of assumptions. And they try to derive the fact that we should use Born weights as our expected to calculate our expected utilities. So one argument is that when you look at the assumptions in their derivation, one of them looks like Laplace's principle of insufficient reason. Basically, it says if you have two branches that have equal amplitude, then you should prefer them equally. You should be indifferent to which branch your future self will be in. And the argument is that actually, right there, you've already assumed that the amplitudes of those branches are related to probabilities. You've just assumed that amplitudes are measures. So you've assumed the thing that you're trying to prove. That's the criticism. David Albert has a different criticism, which is just that it's not enough to show that the Born weights in quantum mechanics dictate how agents would bet. We have to explain why the particular relative frequencies we observe come out the way they do. So the claim here is that Born weights actually tell us something about what we observe in experiments, relative frequencies. And the fact that they might, quantum mechanics might help me figure out how to bet well and win if I'm a rational agent is kind of irrelevant. We have to understand probabilities in this other way of, why is it that we observe the particular relative frequencies we do? Anyways, there's lots of back and forth in this sort of argument. I kind of want to just give you a sketch of what people are saying. If you're interested, go and read the literature. It gets very philosophical and into the foundations of decision theory and so on. Okay, so I'm going to try to wrap up quickly. Let's quickly compare Everett to the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. So in de Broglie, one of the objections people often make, physicists in particular, to Everett is that it's kind of extravagant in its ontology. It assumes that there are these very large number of parallel universes which we don't observe, but they're all happening. And they say, well, doesn't Occam's razor tell us that we shouldn't posit all this extravagant reality? But if you look at the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, remember there were these empty waves. So the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation says there's a universal wave function evolving according to the Schrodinger equation, and there's particle positions. So actually, the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation has everything Everett does. The universal wave function never collapses. It has all those empty waves in it. The Bohmian says those empty waves, you know, don't influence us, and only, you know, one of them's occupied. But the waves are still out there. They're real. They have all the structure. It's just that there's no particle in them. So you could say, well, Bohmian mechanics has everything Everett does plus some particle position. So if anything's extravagant, it must be Bohmian mechanics, not Everett. And you might say Occam's razor prefers Everett to Bohmian mechanics. You could also say, well, unlike Everett, the extra stuff that was added in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, the particle positions, the guidance equation, that stuff, well, what we saw was that it was highly underdetermined by the data we see. It spoils the Lorentz covariance of the theory. All the stuff that was kind of, you know, all the criticisms related to de Broglie-Bohm had to do with that extra stuff that was added. Yes?
So it sounds like there are criticisms of the Everett interpretation. This response is, well, the Everett interpretation is at least better than the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation.
Yes.
And so it's just the lesser of two evils and not really a response to the criticism.
Yeah, so here I'm just going to set Everett and Bohm head to head because I think it's a useful exercise. They're sort of two paradigmatic examples of interpretations of quantum mechanics. I'm not saying that you couldn't just say, well, so much the worse for both of them, I'm going to go with some other interpretation. You could do that. But I think it's useful to just set them alongside one another. Finally, some have argued that, you know, macroscopic reality is actually an emergent pattern in the wave function. So, you know, this whole idea of reality as patterns. And it's not a pattern in the configuration of the Bohmian particles. So the proponent of de Broglie-Bohm wanted to say, well, it's where the particles end up that's important. But, you know, the argument you can make here is that if you ask, you know, how a measurement device responds to a system, or let's say, how does my retina respond to a particle impinging on it? Well, the wave function of my retina responds to the wave packet that comes into it. And even if the Bohmian particle happens to be in one of the sort of really unlikely regions at the tail of the wave packet, it doesn't matter. The wave function of my retina is going to respond in exactly the same way, response to the wave packet. The role of the Bohmian position is just to sort of pick out one branch in this multi-branching structure. But really, all the patterns, you know, in my retina and in devices, all the kind of real structure in the math, that's in the wave function. Why do I need the Bohmian positions? OK, so that, so far, that's been sort of, you know, pro Everett contra de Broglie-Bohm. But the Bohmians want to say, you know, you need to pick out one of those branches of the wave function to have a phenomena, so to solve the Schrodinger cat type problem. And secondly, and this is sort of maybe the main response, we saw that if you take the non-equilibrium distribution of our Bohmian particles, you get different predictions from if you take the equilibrium distribution. How could the Bohmian particle position be irrelevant if the nature of your predictions depends on what its distribution is? So clearly, it can't just be the structure in the wave function. It's got to be where the Bohmian particle ends up. And then you might argue that, you know, in defense of the Bohmians, that, you know, unlike Everett, the interpretation of probability in these models is unobjectionable. You know, one of those wave packets has the particle in it, the others don't, and all those problems with interpreting probability go away only if you introduce these extra variables. Yes?
Can I get some comments about that?
Well, actually, maybe let me just finish because I've gone over time, and we can chat afterwards. But this, I think, gives you an idea that it's, you know, there's reasons pro and con each of these approaches. All right, so let me just sort of wrap up everything and give you sort of the big picture for the course. So we saw all these different ideas for responding to the measurement problem. We didn't really talk about quantum logic or quantum Bayesianism. And one of the themes that ran through was that in some of these approaches, the quantum state is treated as an epistemic concept, and in others, it's treated more like an ontological concept. So in particular, in the psi epistemic hidden variable models, and in this sort of quantum logic, quantum Bayesian approach that we didn't really talk about, psi is more about epistemology. And in the rest of them, like in collapse models, in Everett, and in de Broglie-Bohm, the wave function had the status as something real. But that distinction is not complete because, you know, we already saw that there's sort of an epistemic flavor to the wave function in some of these other models. Like in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, psi squared picked out the probability distribution of the bounding positions. And in that sense, so in the one that has the equilibrium distribution, not the suggestions by Valentini, the wave function has this epistemic character. Similarly, over here in Everett, we saw that the relative state of a system, the one that's sort of picked out by an observer, also kind of has an epistemic flavor because it's the state that the observer subjectively assigns to the system, not the objective state of the universe. So on this issue of, you know, ontic versus epistemic, you could ask the following. Well, if psi really is ontic, how do you explain the success of that analogy we saw between quantum states and probability distributions? So we saw a lot of that in the second week. And if the quantum state really is describing reality completely, we would need some explanation for the quality of that analogy. But of course, there isn't currently any good psi epistemic realist interpretation on offer for all of quantum mechanics. So can we find one? Finally, you know, we talked on the very first day about axiomatization of quantum theory, and by the end of the first week, we had some ideas of what those axiom system looks like. So is there a simple set of principles? You know, there's some on offer. They're not as simple as they could be. And the question is, you know, could we find a way perhaps of going beyond quantum theory by starting with those axioms that derive quantum theory and then maybe modifying some of them? Can we make sense of non-locality and contextuality? So, for example, can we resolve the tension between relativity theory, which says that there are no superluminal signals, and quantum theory, which seems to say that we need to have superluminal influences? And more broadly, there's this sort of tension between operationally indistinguishable procedures that are not identical at the ontological level. Can we resolve that tension? And then finally, I would say that the fact that we don't yet have a consensus on how to interpret quantum theory, as we've seen, suggests that we still haven't understood it. I think if somebody came along with an interpretation that was so compelling, so clearly right, then it wouldn't be difficult to achieve a near consensus that is the right way to interpret theory, and we haven't yet. So I like to think that, you know, we'll know that we understand quantum theory at some day in the future when, you know, it is somebody gives a view that is so compelling that it can achieve consensus. And I would suggest that it may be that some of the disagreements, which currently don't really seem to be disagreements about physics so much as they're disagreements about philosophy, like the disagreement between the realists and the operationalists. And it seems like, you know, clearly that's going to persist in the future because it has to do with people's preferences. I would suggest that if the correct interpretation of quantum theory was, you know, was proposed and it was very compelling, and it might actually force us to sort of admit some middle ground between the realists and the operationalists. I don't think that dichotomy is absolute. And so actually, not only could a correct interpretation sort of revolutionize physics and lead to many new experiments and new ideas, it could also, in a way, change what we think science is ultimately about. And that's it for the course. The only thing that remains is to announce the winner of the contextuality correlation prize. And drum roll, please. It's Miriam. So congratulations. So let me tell you.